Hello, this is Do Go On. I'm Matt Stewart.
And I'm Taran Jayamana.
And we're in Sydney. And we're about to be in Brisbane. And we're doing live shows. They're called Dryer Dryer. And also, Who Knew with Matt Stewart in both those cities. And you can get details at mattstewartcomedy.com. Anything else you want to tell the good listeners at Do Go On, Taran?
Well, the whole point of this was you thought that it might be more engaging if you had a different voice. But you've said most of the information. So, hey, come see us in Sydney and Brisbane.
Yeah, that was engaging.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome aboard another episode of Do Go On. My name is Dave Warnocky and I am sitting across from a man named Mr. Matt Stewart. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Dave. How's it going? It is good. I asked how's it going and I wasn't going to give you a space.
How's it going? It is good to be here.
How's it going? It's good from where I'm sitting. Hopefully it's good from where you're sitting as well. Hey, Dave, can I stop you right there?
Absolutely.
Sorry to touch your lips like that.
Oh, my lips are now sealed.
Extended pointer finger. You'll probably have a more scientifically correct word for that biologically.
The index finger.
Index finger, thank you. Is that, okay. But I'll stop you right there.
Oh, sorry, the index finger's back.
I'd love to introduce you to a very good friend of mine, one of my best.
Oh.
I'm a very big fan of this person.
Yep.
It's Jess Perkins. Please make her feel welcome. She's here every week.
Please make her feel welcome. I feel like doing a round of applause, but that would sound less welcoming
Please
than no applause.
Yeah. Please do it.
Jess Perkins, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that terrible?
No, I love it.
How are you, Jess?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am good now, but just to give us a bit of insight into our personal lives, we just enjoyed a delicious Indian curry meal together.
We did. Yeah.
Two types of curry, one type of rice, and it was way too much rice.
Yeah,
it was too much rice. We had a cute little do-go-on family dinner.
Yeah.
It was nice.
It was delightful.
Mm-hmm. It was good.
I got there. I ate very slowly, but we got to
you
the food.
You did well. You ate like a big boy.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
You were so, like, during the meal, you were stopping me from joking about how slowly he eats.
Mm.
But on mic.
Oh, I'll rip into anyone. No, that's the thing. It's a real waste because I'm quite maternal, but I don't think I want kids. It's a real waste.
I don't know if that's a waste.
Nah.
So you can just mother the world.
We are the world.
You know what you can do? I heard of this recently.
Mm.
I think maybe it was even on another podcast.
You listen to other podcasts?
Yeah, I was listening to Dave Warnocky on... Maybe it was... No, it was, I don't know what it was. Anyway, I heard this term, mumsplaining. And that's where, like, a dad is out with their kids. And they may be, like, feeding them or doing something, changing a nappy or something. And then a mum or, you know, a stranger will come up and say, everything okay here? I find that it's actually easier to...
What?
But yeah, that's really interesting. Apparently that happens a bit. It's like, I kind of like the fact in some ways that there is one little thing out there that men get patronized about because it often goes the other way. Like, mansplaining is just across the whole board. So mumsplaining is just
But
little...
I do hate that too because I hate when people assume, like, the dad is the inferior parent.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no, not the case at all. I mean, in the case in my family, but not in all. So
not necessarily. Well, to be on the, I mean, statistically, sure.
Well, to jump on the other side of the fence here, I, as someone who is terrible at doing nearly everything in their life, practical tasks, I mean, I would love it if someone came up and said, "Hey, mate, that's not how you grill a grilled cheese sandwich."
What?
I'd love that if they came up. And,
really?
Things got explained to me.
But even if you were doing a fine job and you,
well, when it comes to grilled cheese, I'm not doing a fine job.
What about this? This is
how do you fuck up grilled cheese?
All right, so we've got an electric, I don't even know what that's called. What's it called? Stove. See, that's how bad I am at cooking.
Oh, God.
Electric stove. I've never had one before. And apparently it takes a long time to heat up. And I had the grilled cheese on there for 10 minutes, not doing anything. Like, it wasn't melting at all. And then I come back a couple of minutes later, it's just burnt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't leave it for that long.
Yeah.
And if I'd been doing that in a park and a mum had come up, I would have been like, "Thank you, Mum."
Well, yeah, I don't know if the mums needed... That's just parenting, I think.
Thanks, Dad. What I'm saying is I need help. It's a cry for help, I'm sorry.
All right.
There is an extension from that as well. So, like, to go with that analogy of the cheese instead of the parenting, that also there will be... Mums might go up to the dad and they'll say, and he's just like, say, feeding the baby a bottle, and they'll be like, "Hey, good on you. That's really great to see." It's like, just doing the bare minimum of what being a parent is.
So
just
it's
like
not the mother of the child, just random lady.
Yeah.
So I think you meant the mum's coming in going, "Thanks for helping out." And you're like, "The wife should never thank him."
No.
Yeah,
oh, no,
strangers.
No, yeah,
strangers.
Yeah, strangers.
Strangers
saying,
"Oh, aren't you good?
That,
good on you."
So if you're doing the grilled cheese and a stranger just comes up to you in the park with your electric stove, and
which
you
you've
go,
taken
"Hey,
to the
good on
kid
you,
park.
Mate. Cooking for yourself. Well done."
I'd love if I was eating...
Who's a big boy?
I'd love if I was eating banana in a park and a mum came up and said, "Fruit, good choice," and kept walking.
Oh, actually, yeah, that'd be sick. That'd be so good.
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't mind. Depends on how they do it, but interesting. I found it. I'd never heard the term mumsplaining.
I quite like that too. When you said mumsplaining, I thought it was just the unnecessary over-explaining, like my mum does. Like, "What's for dinner?" And she talks about something that happened in 1973, and you're like, "Oh my God, Mum!"
And do they ever say things like, I've been around conversations where a couple of parents are talking, you know, and you're around for dinner at someone's house, and they'll be telling you a story about their uncle or something, and I'll say, He was gay, by the way. And anyway, so he...
It's so irrelevant.
And he was a dentist, by the way.
Yeah.
Both of those things happened in the same conversation once for me. He was a gay dentist, but...
But one at
like,
a time?
Neither of those things...
Was it a gay dentist? He was gay. Moving on. Oh, he was also a dentist.
Yeah, and neither time did it affect the story in any way.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with it.
Great. That's...
What I find with my mum is she'll start to ask a question and I know what she's asking, so I'll answer her. But then she still finishes.
Yeah.
Like, what time is the 7:30 show tonight? And you're like, "I've already told you. Sweet Jesus, come over here and I will strangle you to death."
Oh, really?
Yeah, I get quite aggressive.
I hear that.
I don't. She's super cute. Nobody touches
Annie,
her. She's the best.
Hey, only if you're going to touch her with hugs and love.
I try and then she says, "Get off me. Personal space, Jess." That's true. I do that all the time. I climb on her.
Geez, you're hot and cold with your mum.
I really am. 0 to 60, they call me.
Oh, miles or kilometres?
Temperature.
Oh. Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit.
Oh, it's not that warm.
I'm pretty cold still.
You've got,
even when I'm hot, I'm cold.
Low range.
I hope your report will be hot today, which is what we're all here to do, is that for you to just to... research a topic and report back to Matt and I, and how we doing, how we looking.
Fine, we're looking A-okay, no problems here. All right.
Your reports are always of the finest quality.
Thanks, yes. Ringo Starr.
Oh, that wasn't, I didn't even mean to be doing an accent there.
You just slipped into it.
Your reports are always, oh no, oh boy, oh dear.
Not bad.
That's Ringo pulling out of an impression of himself. Jess... what have you got for us?
Okay, well, we always start with a question.
Yes,
and we do. I have thought out my question really thoroughly.
Yeah, I know. I know you were saying earlier that you started with the question and then you built a report around it, so
yeah,
it should be pretty rock solid.
Which makes sense. So,
oh no, that's the opposite of what you said.
I just added this a minute ago because I feel like sometimes the questions are going to feel a little bit too obvious, but we'll have a bit of a go and see if you can guess. So, my question to you is. What's wrong?
No need to mumsplain the question there, Jess. No, please do go on.
Who do you think is the most influential group of comedians?
Is it... I was researching the Friars Club today. Do you know the Friars Club of New York City?
Yeah, that rings a bell.
They organise a lot of the celebrity roasts. Over 100 years.
Yes. And yes.
In an episode of Seinfeld, Jerry gets to go to the Friars Club and then to go in there, you have to wear a jacket, and then a performer takes his jacket. Anyway, it's called the Friars Club.
Totally, yeah.
But I was thinking,
not the Friars Club.
Is it the Melbourne open mic comedy scene?
It is. I will be doing a report on my peers, and I will be ranking them
from 1 to 279.
Is it?
Oh, is it just the Melbourne International Comedy Festival?
No, that would be.
Wait, what was it? The group?
Influential. Yeah, that's a big key.
Is it the Footlights?
Oh, no.
Cambridge Footlights?
Yeah.
But it kind of came from that.
Okay. Then I'm guessing it's...
Oh, is it the Goon Show?
Oh, they also worked alongside them, but no.
Yeah, the Goon Show came just before Monty Python.
Yeah.
I love Monty Python.
That's an awesome topic.
Are you a Monty Python fan as well?
I like them. I always feel weird about the fan thing. I feel like I don't know enough to call myself a fan.
Sure.
Unless you mean liking them.
Yeah.
If you mean liking them, then I'm a fan, but I'm not a full-on knowing everything about them kind of guy.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm really like that either. And I don't even, I think you've got to be realistic. I don't love every single thing they've done because they are very absurd, right, and like out there and wacky. But a lot of their stuff I very much enjoy.
Sometimes they are really quite silly.
They're very, aren't they?
Just a tad.
Just a bit bloody silly.
No, I think they are very funny, and I would agree that they are definitely some of the most influential comedians.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. And like one of the, I think in American comedy, because, you listen to a lot of American comedians talk and stuff, and they are normally influenced from the inside, like American comedians influencing Americans. But one of the names that comes up a lot from outside of America would be Monty Python.
Absolutely, yeah. I was watching like a documentary on YouTube about them, and lots of Americans were interviewed about them. Even like Jim Carrey as well. I remember watching an interview with Jim Carrey. Robin Williams was talking about them.
Jim Carrey technically Canadian, but I guess that is Canadian. North America.
Mike Myers.
Continental.
Sorry. I find it so annoying when people pull other people up on bullshit things. And I did it to be funny, but it wasn't funny. It was just annoying.
I believe Mike Myers is also Canadian.
That's why I said speaking.
You just said that, you piece of shit.
I was doing the volume gesture not loud enough.
Okay.
Just off mic here. On mic, but off the record.
No, I'll be louder. So I've broken it up into almost like a timeline, I suppose. I'm going to look at their origin.
Great.
And some of their TV and film work. And then what have they done beyond? Okay, just a little index of what we've got coming up. Is it an index at the start, or index is at the back of the book?
Index at the back, I think, with the glossary.
Glossary.
You want the table of contents.
Table of contents
is the word. Yep.
So what you just got there, and then it wouldn't be a Jess Perkins report
without
fun facts. Just prefacing again what we have to look forward to.
I love that you outline. It's like a proper lecture, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't mean to.
This is what will be covered today. Time for questions at the end. Please hold them.
I was wondering why you were standing at that lectern, but that makes sense.
BYO lectern.
And why we're in a lecture theatre with 250 Melbourne University students.
I hope it's not too echoey.
So in the early to mid-60s at Oxford University, history student Michael Palin met English student Terry Jones. Meanwhile, over at Cambridge University, another English student, Eric Idle, met law student John Cleese and medical student Graham Chapman. So you look at, they've got a fair broad range there, don't they?
Sounds like bloody tism.
Doesn't it? What were their specialties, though?
No, I don't know.
They sound like very educated dudes.
Yeah, and like a real mix there. So you've got a couple of English students, you've got history, law, and medicine. I think medicine being the least useful. Meanwhile, Terry Gilliam was studying political science at the university in Los Angeles. Ever heard of it? Probably.
Known
as LA.
Quite a well-known.
The city of angels.
Yeah, does that ring a bell? So working together in various sort of sketch groups and comedy troupes across both universities, it sort of led on to John Cleese got a role on At Last, the 1948 show. And following the success of a program that the others were on, so the others were all on a program called Do Not Adjust Your Set, which was like a tea time children's program.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was kind of cool because they said that because it was on at about 5:25 in the evening, so they had this weird crossover audience of like kids, but also parents or like adults coming home from work. So they were really fucking about and being very, very silly.
Silly boys.
They're being silly boys.
It's great when you watch something like a kid's show like Play School back now. They make mistakes and stuff, but they just do it all in one take. And they laugh with each other. When you're a kid, you don't notice that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But
sometimes they look at the camera like, you see that? Anyway, well, I stuffed up that cardboard thing. Anyway, let's start singing. Like, and they sort of laughed with each other.
How often are you watching Play School now?
I'm trying to cut back. I'm weaning myself off.
Sure.
I'm four nights a week. I used to be five.
Yeah, sure.
Four.
Following the success of their program, Do Not Adjust Your Sets, ITV, the network, offered Gilliam, Idol, Jones and Palin their own late-night adult comedy series together. So they're in the, like, early to mid-20s.
And so this is Terry Gilliam's been given a go as well.
Yeah. So he sort of joined them. He came across and was writing for Do Not Adjust Your Set. Well, not writing, but he was doing, like, all the animations.
Oh,
and
cool.
Stuff.
So he's already got his sort of weird style. He's the guy that does the animations, Terry Gilliam. Yeah.
There's videos on YouTube of him teaching you how to do it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I remember I was watching a documentary and Michael Palin was saying like what impressed him most about Gilliam's work was his comic timing. Like it's quite basic animation, I would say. Like he says that, but I couldn't do it, so it can't be that. I can't.
And
do
also, this was done 50 years ago, so it's, you know, it's easier. You probably could do it yourself now, but probably not back then.
Probably not back then. So he was like very talented, but his timing and stuff was very, very funny. And so they were offered their own late night show, which was awesome. But the network had said, you've got to wait about 18 months until we can give you a studio. Like there was no time for them. So they had to wait about 18 months. But at the same time, Graham Chapman and John Cleese were offered a show by the BBC. The BBC had been impressed by their work on The Frost Report and At Last the 1948 show. So John Cleese was apparently quite reluctant to do a two-man show for various reasons, including Graham Chapman's supposedly difficult and erratic personality. Apparently,
loose unit.
Bit of a loose unit. I think this is sort of in the early stages of his alcoholism.
Drinking.
Yeah, yep. He's trouble with booze.
Also, if there's only two of you, that's two people have to write half an hour a week. That's really a lot of...
Yeah, so it's like it's a lot more pressure, so you bring other people on board. So He brought Palin on because they knew each other, having worked on How to Irritate People, which was like another program they were working on.
So they've worked on many shows.
Yeah, and these are like, well, a lot of these are also like radio. They did a lot of radio plays. They wrote for shows. They weren't always the performers. They did a lot of writing. So he invites Palin to come along, who brings Terry Jones and Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam with him.
He's like, all right. You can have me, but I'm a package.
Yeah.
It's me plus four or nothing.
I'm bringing the rest of the gang. So, yeah, they brought along Gilliam as well to do all the animations and stuff like that. And when it came to, like, their actual writing process, you may know this, but, like, apparently Eric Idle always wrote alone. He wrote by himself. John and Graham wrote together. Terry G, he animated alone, obviously. Just worked alone.
It's just his personality.
Yeah, he just liked to animate alone. And Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote together. So they had their little groups, their little writing partnerships that kind of worked for them. And what I really like is that they had a very definite idea about what they wanted to do with their series. So they admired the work of acts like Peter Cook and Alan Bennett, Dudley Moore, and they'd worked on the Frost Report. And they enjoyed Cook and Moore's sketch show Not Only But Also, but the one problem that they saw was that the these programs had great sketches, but the writers would sort of struggle to find a punchline funny enough to end on, and that would kind of
so the comedy was missing.
Yeah.
Your comedy is great. It just doesn't have any more jokes.
Yeah. I really enjoy your comedy, but it doesn't... It's not funny.
Mm, it's like a dramatic play, but we could wrap that up with a joke at the end.
Yeah. If we just put in a punchline.
I don't know if you guys are misunderstanding that on purpose or not, but that's not what it said. It said they were very funny sketches.
Uh-huh.
They just didn't have the big the big bang laugh at the end.
Oh.
It was before the days where you could just, you know, drop some dubstep at the end and move on.
Thinly veiled stab at our very good friends, Auntie Donna.
No, those guys have great punchlines.
And those great dubstep.
Oh, yeah, fucking nice.
And rock and
should
bods.
Go see them at the comedy festival if that's not over yet.
It is not.
It's not over yet. Perfect. But they've probably sold out.
Well, you should watch their DVDs.
Yeah, because they're amazing. Anyway, so like they were saying that their sketches were good, but the lack of hilarity kind of detracted from the overall quality, right? So they decided.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah,
that's nasty.
You understand, though, don't you?
Oh yeah, no, totally.
Do I need to explain it again?
If just one more time.
Okay, so it's funny, yeah. But it's not funny enough.
It's not funny.
Not ha ha funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gentle.
It's gentle funny. It's like kind of funny.
That's
but they kind
of the sketches
that
I write. I love it, writing a gentle sketch. Even a sad one.
Yeah, I love a sad sketch. Yeah. Mm, some of the best. Ugh. So the Python boys decided that they would not bother to cap their sketches in the traditional manner. So in early episodes of Flying Circus, which is a series that they sort of went on to make, they make great play of this abandonment of the punchline. So like in one scene, Cleese turns to Idol as the sketch descends into chaos and remarks, "This is the silliest sketch I've ever been in." And they all resolve not to carry on and just walk off the set.
Yeah.
So like they broke those sorts of barriers a lot.
That's very clever. Looking at someone else and thinking, your sketches are great, but it's not that funny at the end.
Yeah.
Instead of just making it funny at the end, which is obviously very difficult.
It is fucking
impossible.
They
just abandoned ship.
Maybe not impossible. It's very hard to do that consistently.
But then also making the abandonment funny.
Very good.
Yeah. But they took that, so now no one else can really use it. Jerks.
Yeah, that's true.
That's very Python-esque. What, just because they invented it and I'm basically ripping it off? Then, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I guess so.
Whatever. Anyway, just going to go on with my funny walk sketch and good day to you, sir.
I love that funny walk sketch, though.
My funny walk sketch?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I believe you mean silly walks.
No, mine's the funny walk sketch.
Oh, of course. Very good.
Yeah, you haven't seen Matt's funny walk sketch.
Oh, I think I have.
It's just him walking, to be honest. He's got a funny walk. He bounces a lot as he walks. It's
Look,
weird.
I
it's unsettling.
It's not a... I wouldn't say it's a rip-off. It's more of an homage.
Oh.
It's a what?
An homage.
And you have a certain...
Je ne sais quoi. I guess you could say it. I don't know. It's up to you.
If you want to get technical.
Dave tried. If you want to get a technical.
Technicale.
Oh, fuck.
Would have been way better.
Weren't you teaching yourself Spanish or something? Spanish?
Si.
Anyway, they're working together and trying to figure out what sort of style they're going to create. And Terry Jones remembered an animation that Gilliam had created for Do Not Adjust Your Set called Beware of the Elephants, which had intrigued him with its stream of consciousness style. So that's kind of how their style began, because it was kind of a stream of consciousness. It just kept going into nothing in a way, and then different things would come in and change it and would go a bit nuts, much like a stream of consciousness.
Oh.
Yeah, there it is. They often used one of Gilliam's animations to move from the closing image of one sketch to the opening scene of another, so they sort of used it as like a segue, kind of.
A transition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, segue's probably better, but that's fine.
Do you see how he tried to mumsplain that to you?
Yeah. What's the difference, Dave?
Was that worth correcting her about?
I definitely regret it.
Good decision.
Well, no, I don't regret anything. I'm pretty great.
They treated writing like a 9-to-5 job, so their approach was quite democratic. And if the majority found an idea humorous, it was included in the show. I quite like that.
That is cool.
I mean, it does sort of seem like it should be how it is, but I imagine when you're working in a big group, it can be very challenging.
Okay, but if you're working on your own, which two of them are,
yeah,
you've got to convince more because you obviously find it
what
funny.
An
but if you're in a
point.
You're in a duo, you've got two already. Otherwise,
they might have
that's perfect.
Formed a coalition.
No, you're absolutely right, because John Cleese made the same point. He said he felt sorry for Eric, who was like writing by himself, because it wasn't quite the same for Terry Gilliam, because you know, yeah,
he was in.
Yeah, but he would come with ideas, or they would say, this is what we're doing, and he would make ideas around that. Whereas Eric would be writing stuff, and if he couldn't convince them that it was fun, like he's, yeah, you're right. In a group of two, you've already got two votes. He was just like, just him.
What, one more, and then you've got it?
Well, maybe his vote should have been worth two.
Maybe, but I don't think they thought of that at the time.
Apparently, one of them was a doctor, so obviously not a mathemagician.
Mathemagician.
Mathemagician. Very good. All right.
You got relayed around the room, that one.
Okay, so the casting of the roles for their sketches was also quite unselfish, I guess you could say, since each member viewed himself primarily as a writer rather than an actor. They weren't desperate for screen time. There was no divas fighting over it. They just kind of let it go, which is kind of cool. And while the show was a collaborative process, different factions within Python were responsible for elements of their team's humour. They got to a point, because when I was in Year 12, my Year 12 drama solo had to have Python-esque comedy. So I watched a lot of Monty Python. As research, Mum would be like, why don't you do your homework? I'm like, I am doing my homework, Mum. So what I was saying, though, was it got to a point, because I was watching so much Monty Python, that I could identify who had written which bit, because there's certain styles that go with each sort of writing team, right? So the Oxford-educated members, like Terry Jones and Palin, they were more visual, more fanciful, and a little bit more out there. So like the Spanish Inquisition, for example, was one of theirs. But the Cambridge graduates, so Cleese and Chapman, who wrote together, they tended to be more verbal and more aggressive, which I think you can see in Cleese's performances. More confrontational, where one character intimidates or hurls abuse. that's sort of their
just
style.
Just imagining is very funny, yeah.
But it's true. Like you can start to think of sketches and you're like, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Whereas Eric Idle's characters were like lots of verbal quirks, and his were really language-based. So like the man who speaks in anagrams would have been him. Like he just, he was really wordy.
What was that character of the nod and a wink?
Say no more, say no more, nudge, nudge. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
That's a famous one.
That is a good one.
So I'm a very shallow.
Say no more.
Divin too deeply. Is that what you?
Divin.
Like instead of.
Divin.
Like past tense of dove.
Dived.
Divin.
Past tense of dove. That is a past tense, but that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I haven't.
I'm very wordy as well. I'm a little bit like Eric Idle.
Yeah, you definitely are.
You're the Eric Idle. You're the Gilliam.
But please, Jess, do go on.
There were other names for the show. Did you know that? So before they came up with Flying Circus, they had some other options.
What are they? Hit me.
Okay, here we go. Owl Stretching Time.
That's funny. So Monty Python, Owl Stretching Time.
Yeah. Matt's great. Doing a Perkins. I love
that
it.
Was a three people think of a word.
Yeah.
And then go.
And then away they go. Like, finish the sentence. The toad elevating moment.
Nah, two words. No, you wouldn't remember that.
A horse, a spoon, and a bucket.
Really?
That's okay. Pretty funny. Vaseline review.
My personal favourite is still number one.
Owl stretching time. Bun, wacket, buzzard, stubble, and boot. Bit wordy.
Too wordy.
Owl stretching time, you're a fan of?
Yeah, was that on the short list?
I think it was. I've
still got more.
Well, that's it.
The Vaseline review is my favourite.
You like Vaseline review? Yeah. I quite like a horse, a spoon, and a bucket. Out of the three of us, though, who would be the horse? What are you laughing at? My laugh there?
Yeah.
Who would be the horse, the spoon, and the bucket here?
Out of us three?
Yeah.
Ooh.
As a kid, if I played Monopoly, I was always the horse.
Okay, you could be the horse. Spoon and bucket.
As a kid, I often ate with a spoon. Mm.
I shat in a bucket. Fuck, I wish I could keep a straight face.
Well, she's laughing. True? Laughing because it's true.
I don't know. Hasn't everybody shat in a bucket?
Tragedy plus time.
Big time.
Oh.
Filled a bucket or two in my day. Oh, no, that's no good.
But you are a horse.
That is awful. Just, I hate shit humour. All right.
Just once I wish I could keep a straight face for a joke. Yeah, well. Right, so they had all those other options for names, but Flying Circus stuck because BBC had printed that name in their schedule and were not willing to amend it.
So did they even think of it?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, yeah, so they did. Yeah, yeah, was...
They went through and went, well, we're not going to call it Vaseline Review.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of there's all sorts of theories as to where Monty Python came from. Like, I couldn't even really find a...
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I couldn't even find a proper... like reason. There was too many different ones, but there's a few.
Oh,
theories.
Wait, so they were, as in, sorry, I was thinking they were the names for Flying Circus, so they, that was decided it was Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yeah.
They weren't called Monty Python yet.
Yeah, they weren't.
Oh, right.
So
the
show itself was called Monty Python's Flying Circus. They weren't as a group called Monty Python.
Right. I didn't realize that.
That sort of came later after.
Well,
they...
that makes sense because this is the first thing they did together.
Yeah. But they sort of, like, later when they worked on other projects, they kind of dropped the Flying Circus but kept Monty Python, so that became their group name.
Yeah.
But at first, I think it was just all part of it.
So, oh, I'm also, I always thought they'd chosen the Monty Python part. So they were just going to be called and known in history as the Vaseline Review.
Yeah, or...
God, that's funny now.
But they would have dropped the review after that show and just been called the Vaseline.
And then everyone would be like, lawsuits.
The Vaso Boys.
And then
Vaso Boys.
You'd be doing comedy like that and you'd be like, well, it's a bit Vaseline-esque, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Jess, we're going to need you to do some Vaseline-esque.
Vaseline-esque.
But French.
Yeah, U12 solo.
French
Vaseline-esque, please.
Oui.
And go.
Oh, my lips, they are so chapped.
I'm super offended.
Are
all
you?
Of that, yeah.
Why?
Because you have chat lips and you got a French background.
Yes, exactly, Dave. Bit of sensitivity, please.
Well, let's do a Monty Python, not wrap this up, and move on to the next bit.
Yeah, he's learning. Fuck you, Matt. Anyway, the first episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus was broadcast on the 5th of October 1969. Apparently, not to the most impressed audience. They did have a live studio audience.
So even though, because when you do TV, you put it out there and you're like, well, I wonder if people will like it. But you're doing the show in front of an audience that are hating it, and then you know that it's going to go to like times 100,000.
Exactly.
Of this.
And have you been to any live tapings of comedy shows?
Yes.
I've been to a few, like, I went to a few of the late shows in America and stuff, and every live comedy show I've ever seen, they're like, just laugh, even if you don't get it. Laugh. Is it Letterman? They're like, laugh.
Yeah.
You'll get it on the way home. Just laugh now, otherwise you'll regret it later. Just laugh
That's
at everything.
So if
what a line! Oh, man, I'm going to say that at the start of my comedy festival show.
If you think it's a joke, just laugh. If there's a pause, laugh. Just laugh. Please laugh.
Wow.
And they're just like, yeah, everyone laugh, and then let's all practice a laugh.
And then do they do a setup, or they just go, and go, and then everyone just goes, ha ha.
Maybe. I might be making that sound more fucked than it was. That might have been applause and stuff. They do that.
Yeah, they do that for applause and stuff. But, like, I wrote for a community TV show that was filmed in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And when you're really proud of your jokes, and, like, the producers have laughed really hard during the rehearsal, and then you do it in front of an audience and get, like, a, it's like, oh, okay. I'm going to rethink all of my life choices.
I think I bombed some of your writing on that show one time, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
So they're doing it in front of a live audience.
The writing was very strong.
Thank you.
It was definitely the performance in that case.
Yeah.
But in this case, they can't blame anything because they've written it and they're performing it.
Exactly
you
right.
You can blame the fuckhead audience. They weren't ready for it.
You know what, though? Like,
I guess, well, in history now you can blame them because clearly it's pretty great because we're still talking about it.
Yeah,
but was it... I think to just be confronted with that with no context, you would be like, what the hell is... And it was so different to anything else that was being done.
And also, sketch comedy is very hit and miss. I don't know if you guys know that.
Back to Python, are they pretty upset that their show's not going so great?
I think they were a little disappointed, yeah. In an interview, like, Michael Palin said he remembers, like, so they all went to, like, the bar. Because it was, again, it was, like, a late show. So it was, I think it was on nearly 11 p.m. It was quite late. And they sort of had drinks at the bar. And a lot of their friends were like, oh, just gotta run off. Just gotta get babysitter. And he was like, you don't even have kids. Like,
just
people not wanting to hang out. And
ghosted it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so it was a bit awkward, but...
So
brutal.
Right, but they kept going. They just kept going, and they actually ended up doing fairly well, obviously, as we now know.
Yeah, I mean, they've been honoured here today.
Exactly, and once you've made it onto a podcast, I mean, what more is there?
Well, this is the final chapter.
Yeah.
We're closing the book.
Are you going to have to recap this in the recap?
Yeah. I'll get to that. That's in fun facts.
Okay, great. I thought I was wondering why you were writing still with one hand.
Yeah, I'm recapping.
Yes, in an April episode of Do Go On podcast, the Monty Python were mentioned.
So they, Flying Circus, the show kind of popularized a few different styles, such as like a cold open. So like when an episode would start without traditional opening titles or announcements. So they used to do one that was like the It's Man. So Palin would like make this huge journey across really difficult terrains, finally get to the camera and go, It's, and then it would cut him off and it would be the title sequence. Right, it was like this really long drawn out and then they'd cut him off.
That's fantastic.
I love a cold open.
Oh, great. Good stuff.
I love a good cold open.
I love a cold hour, which is what I often deliver.
I like a cold shower.
I like a mulled flower.
I like a bold cower. It's when you cower boldly.
Oh.
Sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, that sounds...
I'll do it. I'll show you.
Okay.
Well, oh, yeah, yes.
He's doing it.
My word.
Good heavens.
Thanks.
Holy moly.
Very good. That was...
I'll take it up to 10.
Oh, too much.
I can't even look at it. God, my eyes are burning.
What's Sorry about that, guys. Noise? I'm back.
They also they disliked finishing with punchlines, you know, that hack move. So they experimented with ending the sketches by cutting abruptly to another scene or an animation, or they'd walk off stage, or they'd address the camera, known as breaking the fourth wall in the industry, if you're in it.
I think that is my favourite kind of segue, is like an anti-punchline or a...
Just break it.
Break it or, yeah.
Yeah.
Walking between the two, like if they just roll into the next sketch.
Yeah, I think it's clever.
When it's done well, I reckon that is my favourite kind of transition, as Dave would say, or segue, as Jess Perkins would say.
Thank you for giving me a surname there.
Or just midi bit, as I would say.
A midi bit. Another type of midi bit that they would use would be just introducing a totally unrelated event or character. So the best example of this was the use of Chapman's anti-silliness character, the Colonel, who would walk into sketches and order them to stop because things were becoming far too silly, which I love. I love that it's like a Colonel and he's like telling them off like naughty kids. It's the best.
Yeah.
Another favourite way of ending sketches was to drop a cartoonish 16-ton weight prop on one of the characters when the sketch seemed to be losing momentum. Or a knight in full armour, played by Terry Gilliam, would wander on set and hit characters over the head with a rubber chicken before cutting to the next scene. You know, because they're just like, okay, what makes sense here? None of this. Excellent. Good. A knight with a rubber chicken. Fair enough.
I guess it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make a lot of sense. Why is he holding a rubber chicken? Why not a sword?
I mean, I hadn't really thought about it like that. But yeah, I see that now.
Yet another way of changing scenes would be when John Cleese, usually in a dinner suit, would come in as a radio commentator and in his pompous manner make a formal announcement, and now for something completely different, which later became the title of the first Monty Python film.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp.
I got to get something off my chest.
Okay.
I ate your last biscuit.
I was saving them for my wedding.
That has been stressing me out. I'm so sorry. It feels a lot better to get that off my chest. You know, keeping things bottled up can affect people negatively, and that had been affecting me, and that's a weight off my shoulders.
Yeah.
It was delicious. I'm not sorry, but I did take the last biscuit.
That he was saving for his wedding.
I didn't know that.
That is upsetting to hear, but I think I'm going to have to get some positive coping skills, learn to set some boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's very convenient. It's flexible. You can fit it around your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and you get matched with a licensed therapist.
You too can get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/DGO today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DGO.
So over the next 4 years, they produced 4 series of the show, 45 episodes. And despite the success of the show, because they actually ended up doing quite well, John Cleese left the group at the end of the 3rd series. He says he felt as if they were repeating themselves and that he and Graham had only written 2 truly original things in the last in that final 3rd season.
And they did another one without him.
They did another one sort of without him. So he was still credited as a writer, I think, on like 3 of the episodes. They were given 13, but they only did 6 because they were like, we've only got enough for 6.
Right.
Yeah.
So they kind of agreed with him.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess they must have. And so he was also apparently finding it difficult to work with Graham Chapman, who was at that point in the full throes of his alcoholism. And according to an interview with Idol, Eric Idle, he said, it was on an Air Canada flight on the way to Toronto when John turned to all of us and said, "I want out." Why? I don't know. He gets bored more easily than the rest of us. He's a difficult man, not easy to be friendly with. He's so funny because he never wanted to be liked. That gives him a certain fascinating, arrogant freedom.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? Like, it's brutal, but I like that brutal honesty. Like, he's a hard person to be friendly with.
Also, I imagine that it'd be just great if he was on a different part of the aeroplane to them. He's in business class because he's so tall and they're out the back.
True.
I want out! I want out!
He peeks through the curtain.
Yeah. I want out!
Or just gets a hostess to...
Can you just give a message to those guys back there?
I want out.
Send him a bottle of champagne as well.
Yeah, get one.
But
hands them a message, DB Cooper style. Little note.
What a throwback.
What a throwback.
So, yeah, the series Flying Circus kind of fell apart, but that led on to them working on larger projects. So I've got a little list here of their films. Can you name all their films?
Yeah, I reckon. How many are there?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
There's Life of Brian. There's Holy Grail. Holy Grail. And now for something completely different. They're there.
Live at the Hollywood Bowl?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that counts.
Yeah, bang, exactly.
Obviously.
So, and now
you said yeah.
Wait, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. I think there is 6. Live at the Hollywood Bowl is one as well, but I...
Oh,
we're in the name so 5
we
missed, then.
We missed
Wait,
some.
No. No, you've named them all. Have I got it here? No, I don't. Oh, yes, I do have Hollywood Bowl here. There's 5. Well done, Perkins. I can read my own notes. So first was And Now for Something Completely Different, which is a collection of their favourite sketches from...
Yeah, just recut from the TV show,
basically,
isn't it?
Yeah. So that came out in 1971. And then in 1975...
Same year as D.B. Cooper, I was just saying. Sorry, pardon me.
In 1975, they released Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So it
which
was...
Which I think is the funniest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. I think it's... I was going to say I think it's my favourite, but I think Life of Brian's my favourite.
They're probably the two big ones, right?
Yeah, they'd be the two biggest ones, absolutely. So Monty Python, the Holy Grail, obviously following the legend of King Arthur. And apparently it only took 5 weeks to film. Smashed out in 5 weeks. After Holy Grail, a few years later, they released Life of Brian. Because apparently after, on the premiere of Holy Grail... people were saying, what's the next one going to be? What's the next one going to be? And
were they freaking out because they're like, we just made this one?
Well, that's exactly it. Eric Idle made some smart-ass joke about Jesus Christ, a lust for glory, or something like that. He made some sort of joke, and then it became a long-running joke for them. So then they actually decided, instead of... None of them were religious, but they also didn't really see the point in just attacking a religion. So it's not actually about Jesus. It's about a guy who was born at the same time in, like, the and sort of lived a parallel life to Jesus, keeps getting mistaken for Jesus, right? So, but it still caused so much fuss. Like, there was huge outcries from Christian communities against them. They were in a lot of trouble. Great film, though. Super funny.
Did you watch the... I've seen this interview come up a bit on different specials and It's on YouTube in full, I think, where there's a like this kind of flamboyant bishop or something
who
argues against him. And he's, I think he seems a bit, maybe he's a bit drunk and stuff.
Mm.
And John Cleese and that argue like really, like just intelligently, but it's sort of, it's just a, it's a bit of a mess. And it's just crazy to think how...
It's amazing.
And it's
to
just
watch.
Straw man argument after straw man argument.
Yeah. And they, and yeah, John Cleese and Michael Palin. Like, John Cleese stays pretty calm and cool all the way through it. He said in an interview he didn't realize until later how angry and upset Michael Palin was getting.
Yeah.
Who's like, he's actually got a reputation as the friendliest man in Britain, but he was just getting very upset.
Yeah.
And they're both being very sarcastic, and it was brilliant. It's very funny to watch. But the film was written entirely on holiday in Barbados. Somebody had a house, like a friend of theirs had a house, so they all went to Barbados and just wrote.
That's cool.
How cool is that? And it was filmed in Tunisia. Do you know that?
I did not know.
That's where it was filmed.
Dave, Tunisia, what are the surrounding states?
It's in Northern Africa.
Yeah. What borders Tunisia?
It's
Did you know Dave is very good with African geography?
Is he? Mm.
Capital of Tunisia is Tunis. It's not a joke.
I wasn't laughing. I was laughing at you for being a nerd.
It's next to Libya, Algeria.
He's looking like he's got the picture in his head. So
no,
looking
he's
up
looking
at
a map.
It's in Northern Africa, so it's up near Egypt, but a little bit west.
Oh, okay. I thought he was going to do better than that.
It's not bad, though.
I said two countries it's next door to.
It's still
yeah,
better
I'd
than
have
I
no idea.
Do, yeah.
Like, I don't know where anything
So do you know where it was?
I knew it was in Africa, and I knew it was in Northern Africa, but...
I couldn't show you on a map of Europe where I've been.
But if you,
I'm
okay. If I said North Africa and you said no, it's in the Pacific Sea, I would have said, yeah, fuck, all right.
Yeah,
I wish I had.
If you'd said it's like an island off Tasmania, I'd be like, oh yeah, no, totally, totally, that's cool. Whatever.
It's in Tasmania. Oh yeah, no, the deserts of Tasmania.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's
where they filmed it. Right, so they've done that, and then the Monty Python Live at the Hollywood Bowl came out in 1982. That was obviously a live show that was filmed and then released. Yes, Matt?
I was going to say, before we move on from Life of Brian, the fact that I've heard a few people mention, I don't know, I think it's true, is that it was in a big way funded by George Harrison. Is that true?
I've heard that as well.
And he didn't realize, they didn't realize that he'd pretty much put
all his money on the line.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
And they didn't realize that, and they found that out later, and were like, they were glad they didn't, because they would have felt so much more pressure.
Yeah. That is correct. Former Beatle George Harrison did fund mostly Life of Brian, and he also had a cameo in the film.
Oh, right.
As the owner of the mount. That was in my fun facts. Thanks so much for ruining one of my fun facts.
Should have probably thought.
But no, but good one. And it ties in nicely with our Beatles, previous Beatles episode.
But I have heard about him, they didn't realise him putting his money on the line.
Like, yeah, how much?
Because he's a Beatle that he'd have, oh, they've got $1 billion.
Yeah.
But there were, I think at the time, or around the time of the Beatles, George Harrison wrote a song called Taxman, and it was about the current tax laws meant that they were paying something like 90% tax.
What?
So the Beatles were making a lot of money, but not necessarily seeing a lot of it.
Brutal.
But I like that he was in it. I haven't seen it in ages, but if he's as I picture him, he wouldn't have needed much of a makeup artist or any sort of...
Yeah.
to be of the time.
Yeah,
he just kind of blends in. Oh, that's a great film. Now I want to watch that.
Yeah.
He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. Brilliant.
That is really good.
My recall of it is also excellent.
I reckon I would have heard that that phrase or that line a million times before I even knew that it was from...
Yeah, definitely.
Monty Python.
The other one that that we say a lot in my family is like, you are all individuals. And the whole crowd of people go, we are all individuals. And then one little voice goes, I'm not. Brilliant.
That's very good.
So good.
And that is that the same with the... well, now we're just going to start doing lines. But the,
that's fine.
The meek shall inherit the earth. What did he say? I think he said the Greek shall inherit the earth. Or something like that.
Blessed are the cheesemakers.
The cheesemakers?
Yeah,
exactly. I assume they would have said something like that. The cheesemakers.
That sound like you. I really
don't. You could have played one of the women.
Oh, yeah.
They all played their own female characters.
There weren't... That's something that people don't realise. Back in the 70s, there weren't many female actors, so they had to play all the roles themselves.
There weren't many.
Women actors had not been invented yet.
Yeah. They hadn't.
They were invented in the late 70s. So they were nearly around. But
nearly, but not quite.
Technology hadn't quite caught up to their vision.
Exactly. They tried a bit, but they just didn't look like women on film.
Yeah, they don't look the same.
They look like the robots.
And we can't have that. We wanted an authentic look.
It was the
so they just
valley.
Put Terry Jones in a wig and it just had the right look.
And what a woman.
What a woman. So they did have their live show live at the Hollywood Bowl, which was filmed, and the film was released in 1982. And then in 1983, The Meaning of Life came out, which sort of documents a man's life from birth to death in different chapters. Crucially, this was the last project that all six Pythons would collaborate on.
And what year was that? In the 80s?
83. Except for the 1989... compilation Parrot Sketch Not Included, where they're all seen sitting in a closet for 4 seconds. So I think you can pretty safely say that Meaning of Life was the last thing they all did together. And it was the last time that Chapman appeared on screen with the other Pythons. In terms of like film stuff, each of the members sort of after the group kind of split up, it wasn't like a Beatles where they had this big falling out. They just kind of all went their separate ways and did other stuff. So they've all pursued various film, television, and stage projects, but often continued to work with one another, like they'd sort of cameo in each other's work. So many of these collaborations were really successful, most notably A Fish Called Wanda in 1988, written by John Cleese, which he starred in along with Michael Palin.
It's very funny.
It's great.
I haven't seen it. I should check it out.
And the pair also appeared in Time Bandits, which was in 1981, which was directed by Terry Gilliam, who wrote it with Palin as well. And
Time Bandit. I don't think I'm familiar with the time.
I don't think I've seen that one either.
That doesn't bode well.
No, just... I mean, this was still 30 years before we were born. 20 years before we were born.
Oh, right.
Okay. Nope, 10 years.
Okay.
9 years.
All right. speaking of Time Bandits... God, we went from 30 to 9 pretty quick.
I never claimed to be the one who's good at maths.
She didn't, Dave.
I've never said it once.
Dave? So, apology, please.
It's my fault for being good at maths and geography. Oh, God.
What am I good at?
Bloody
what
bringing am I good his at? Own trumpet all of a sudden.
What am I good at? No, really. What am I good at?
You're good at
telling me how I shouldn't be cooking a toasted cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I am good at toasted cheese sandwiches. Okay.
Yes, thank goodness. Hold on to it. You need it.
So, other stuff that they sort of collaborated on. Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote a comedic TV series called Ripping Yarns, which ran for 3 years between 76 and 79.
Oh, great. I didn't know that.
Ripping
might be
good.
Yarns. Be a good one. In 1996, Terry Jones wrote and directed an adaptation of The Wind in the Willows. Have you seen that at all?
I reckon I might have seen it.
I loved it when I was a kid.
In my kid years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it featured four members of Monty Python. So Terry Jones played Mr. Toad. He played it really well. Eric Idle was Ratty. Cleese was Mr. Toad's lawyer. And Michael Palin was the son. What a role.
Oh, the son. I thought it was like...
Not like S-O-N, yeah. S-U-N.
Like the The Sun.
The Sun.
I am familiar.
You are familiar? You know it?
First names.
Biggest star in our solar system, Dave. Do you know that? That's a little geography fact for you.
Nope. It's not.
No, it is.
No, but it's not geography.
I thought you were saying, no, it's not the biggest star.
You're the biggest star, Jess Perkins.
Ah, stop it. So, in 2013, the Pythons lost a legal case to Mark Forrestater, the film producer of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, over royalties for the derivative work Spamalot, which was a big stage play. Eric Idle did that. I was going to talk a little bit more about that later anyway. But so, over royalties in that, they owed a combined £800,000 in legal fees and back royalties.
Oh, so they were trying to not pay the producer at all?
Well, well, I guess so. Like, he was sort of saying that Spamalot was derivative of Holy Grail, which it totally is. Like, it's part of it. Yeah, it's sort of a spin-off, for want of a better word. Right, so they what they did to pay back their legal fees was they proposed a reunion show. So they always are like, no, we won't reunite. Oh, what, we have that big bill? Yeah, okay, we can probably do a show. Yeah. So on the 19th of November in 2013, a reunion show was reported following months of secret talks. And the original plan was for a live one-off show at the O2 Arena in London on the 1st of July 2014 with some of Monty Python's greatest hits with modern topical Python-esque twists, apparently. They're all very old by this point.
Yeah.
Like, this is only 3 years ago, so they're like in their early 70s.
Yeah.
So they don't have the stamina for these big live shows anymore. But they did it, and tickets for this show went on sale in November of 2013 and sold out in 43 seconds.
What? How does that happen?
43 seconds, they're gone.
So can you imagine if you
I can't even type my credit card details in that quick.
No, you would be like...
Yeah, true.
You'd be like, sick, got them. Oh, no.
I guess that counts. I must, because they're like reserved and you get time to do it. So I must count from when. But that is amazing. So everyone in straight away. And 43 that was,
and what's that? Gone. It's like a big stadium, like 20,000.
O2's arena. Yeah, it's huge.
20,000 tickets in 43 seconds. Well, 2 more seconds, you could have sold out another arena.
Would have made Jess feel a bit more comfortable. You know how she hates an odd number like 43.
I do. 45 would have made me much happier. Thank you. But
we'll round it up to a minute if you like.
Yeah. Well, no, because then, no. 45 seconds is fine. But so then they added 9 additional shows.
Nine
additional shows, all of them at the O2, and the last was on the 20th of July. So
and
I mean, they all sold out too.
They all sold. So 10 shows.
Yeah.
And am I remembering this right, that they did like a live broadcast to cinemas around?
Yeah,
like cinemas in Australia,
I remember that too. I don't have the details of it, but I do remember that as well. Yeah,
I got a vague memory of that.
Yeah, and I've got the DVD and I've watched it, and like the behind-the-scenes stuff's really interesting as well.
Yeah, like I remember seeing them like getting changed and just old floppy boys.
Are they having a good time? Are they
they're
just doing it for the money?
They're definitely having
they're
fun.
They're fucking around a real bit. Yeah. They're hanging shit on each other. But I think they all kind of... I don't think they particularly get along.
Yeah.
Like, they're not really best mates. I don't think they ever found it that easy to work together. They just worked so well together. And then there was a comment in that as well from a few of them was sort of like, well, if John Cleese didn't come on board, it wouldn't have happened. Because, like, I think even Michael Palin was saying John Cleese was the star. Like, he was just such an engaging performer that without him, the whole thing wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Which is pretty...
That's kind of generous, I think.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like, that makes it sound like it's not a big group of egos, which I guess it must be on some level.
It has to be, I suppose, yeah. But that was just kind of interesting. So I've got like a few notes on what each of them sort of did individually, and then I got some fun facts.
Great.
Love it.
Are we on board?
Sticking to the contents. Appreciate it.
Happy to help. So we'll start with John Cleese, who was my personal favourite. Apparently not the nicest person in the world, but... my favourite performer. In terms of number of productions, Cleese had the most prolific solo career, having appeared in 59 films.
Bloody hell.
22 TV shows or series. 23 direct-to-video productions. Woohoo! 6 video games and a number of commercials.
Video games.
He often pops up in commercials, doesn't he?
Yeah, in some strange places.
Like bank ads and stuff. It must be worth million bucks to him or something, but wow.
Yeah.
I think, because I think he's been married a couple of times, and I'm pretty sure he says that one of those he regrets a bit because it cost him a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty short marriage, and he had to do a tour, basically, like an interview tour, and he called it the alimony.
Alimony,
too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very good. So you remember things.
I remember some things.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So I think he's been married, I think, 4 times. So his BBC sitcom Fawlty Towers, which he wrote with his then-wife, Connie Booth, is considered the greatest solo work by a Python since the sketch show finished. It's the only comedy series to rank higher than The Flying Circus on the BFI TV 100s list, topping the whole poll. So Fawlty Towers was numero uno.
Oh, man, so great.
It's amazing. It's so good. Like, we studied it in drama in Year 9. Like, we watched Fawlty Towers to learn comedy.
And it's one of those crazy shows.
Your school's pretty big on Monty Python members.
Must have been.
Yeah.
And they wonder why I turned out the way I did.
Very Python-esque.
And bitter. Just a broken, bitter human.
And married 4 times.
Yeah, it's not good.
Sorry, Matt, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
I was going to say it's, I think I've heard other people say this a bit, but it's one of those shows where you're like, if I didn't know, I would assume that there were multiple seasons. I mean, there were two, but I would have thought there would be more seasons and more episodes per season.
Yeah.
So many classic moments that it feels like it was, you know, it could be 40 episodes, not 12 altogether. Yeah,
they just packed it all in. Now, apparently, this is kind of cool. John Cleese apparently based Basil Fawlty on a real person who was called Donald Sinclair, who he encountered in 1970 while the Monty Python team were staying at a hotel in Torquay.
Which is where it was set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The TV show.
So reportedly, Cleese was inspired by Sinclair's mantra, "I could run this hotel just fine if it weren't for the guests." And he later described Sinclair as the most wonderfully rude man I've ever met. Although Sinclair's widow apparently denied this, said he was totally misinterpreted. He was a lovely person. But
you wouldn't want to be the most famous TV jerk. Wanker ever. Yeah.
But if he was being funny, saying, that's just a funny line. I used to say that when I worked at a supermarket. Oh, fuck, this place would be much better without the customers.
It's quite derivative of early John Cleese.
I didn't realise that at the time. I feel like we came to that joke
on your own.
30 years apart.
I don't think you did.
Mate, you stole it. Admit it. Admit it.
During the Python stay, Sinclair allegedly threw Eric Idle's briefcase out of the hotel in case it contained a bomb.
So good. And this guy's supposed to be normal.
He's the best. He complained about Gilliam's American table manners and threw a bus timetable at another guest after they dared ask the time of the next bus. Just threw a bus schedule at him. I love that. In 1999, John Cleese appeared in the James Bond film The World Is Not Enough.
Oh, yeah,
as,
Q.
Yeah, well, no, he was Q's assistant, referred to by Bond as R. And then in 2002, when Cleese reprised his role in Die Another Day, that's when he was promoted to Q.
Because Robert Llewellyn had died.
Ah.
Sand.
Who played Q initially, I guess.
For 17 films, that's right.
17, that's a lot. A couple of fun little facts. There is a species of lemur named after him.
Is that from because there was a lemur in creatures? Dangerous?
Fierce Creatures.
Fierce Creatures.
Yeah. And that's not why, but he really likes lemurs. Yeah, so there's a species of them referred to as Avahi Cleese.
That's really great.
How cool is that?
Man, I think I'd like that in life.
Yep.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
You better believe it.
In 1996, he declined a Commander of the British Empire award badge. What do you get?
That's an honour
medal.
Call that an honour.
What do you get for that? Yeah, so he declined that.
Yeah, you probably do get a medallion or often they get a thing around the neck and a.
Yeah.
But he said no, thank you.
No, thank you. I don't know why. No explanation why. He just said no thanks.
Was it John Lennon that time you told us?
Maybe
that, or
a
he mailed
thing.
It back or something?
That's pretty great. No, he made
he got his chauffeur.
Yeah,
he
made his driver take it back. This is kind of fun. There is a rubbish heap of 45 metres in altitude that has been named Mount Cleese, just outside of Palmerston North, after he dubbed the city Suicide Capital of New Zealand. So he shat all over this place in New Zealand, so they named a heap of rubbish after him.
Oh, wow.
I love that, but I also think he would secretly love that.
I think he might even like that more than the lemur.
Yeah,
everyone's
absolutely.
A winner there.
He would have really enjoyed that. Okay, now Michael Palin. So apart from Fierce Creatures, his last film role was a small part in The Wind and the Willows that I sort of mentioned earlier that Terry Jones had written. And he did, obviously, what he's sort of now known for now is a series of documentaries. He does a lot of travel documentaries. His first one was part of the 1980 BBC television series Great Railway Journeys of the World. Woohoo!
Strap yourself in.
Upfield line.
He travelled through the UK by train because, apparently as a kid he had a hobby of train spotting, so... That seems pretty exciting. Then he also did Michael Palin Around the World in 80 Days. So he's done some other travel stuff, including Pole to Pole. Again, it's his pole dancing adventures. Full Circle with Michael Palin. Michael Palin's Hemingway adventures. Sahara with Michael Palin. Himalaya with Michael Palin.
So he started out slow with trains and now he's gone to some really exotic places.
He's gone heavy. So yeah, he's done a lot of like travel stuff, which is very, very cool. So that's mainly been his bag ever since.
I think I'll just put it out there and say that he's probably my favourite.
I do like Palin.
TV shows and movie sketches.
Yeah, I like him a lot as well. It's bloody tricky.
I don't know
why
we have to have favourites. No, like, we don't have to. Have a favourite Beatle, but I did say it, but I regret it, but I don't because I love him. Anyway.
Yeah, I'd probably have to say Cleese as well, I think.
Who are we up to? Who's next?
Terry Jones is next. This is what I didn't know. He wrote the screenplay for Labyrinth.
Oh, I didn't know
that.
Wow,
that's
either.
A really great claim.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I didn't know that.
That is a fun fact. Isn't before cool? We've gotten to the fun facts.
Apparently his draft, though, went through several rewrites and that sort of thing. So much of the finished film was a little bit different.
Still claim it.
Still claimable.
He didn't actually write the codpiece in. That was written in a later draft.
It was requested by someone else.
Yeah.
Bowie himself.
Cindy Sheinberg.
Sheinberg.
What will we need? A little thing that I like to call a card piece. I'm modeling it now, and you can see how good it makes me look. The fad of the 80s. Welcome, kids. Everyone's wearing card pieces. Yeah.
And call the main character. I'm the Goblin King, Sheinberg.
Sydney!
I'm Sydney the Goblin King, Sheinberg. Write it in.
We need puppets. Kids love puppets.
Get Jim Henson on the phone. Oh, I can't do the accent like you guys.
Dave does it much better.
Jim Henson, I've got you on speed dial. I don't know why either. I'm Sheinberg.
Sheinberg's my favourite character.
From Labyrinth.
Of anything. Terry Jones wrote Labyrinth. What's kind of cool is he did a lot of like TV work as well. He wrote a few children's books, and he also wrote Ripping Yarns with Palin that I sort of mentioned before. He also did like a TV series that challenges popular views of history. So, for example, Terry Jones' Medieval Lives, which he received an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Writing for Nonfiction Program. It argues that the Middle Ages was a more sophisticated period than is popularly thought. So, like, he would sort of go against the grain and make a whole show about it, which is kind of cool.
I like that.
Tell me he's not a Holocaust denier. He didn't do a Holocaust denial special, did he?
No.
Good.
We move over to the other Terry Gilliam. The only Python not born in Britain, he became a naturalised British citizen in 1968 and formally renounced his American citizenship in 2006.
Really?
Which you totally would do, right?
Not when you're like working in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah, did he have to?
He was a British citizen since 1968.
Yeah, exactly. It's like 34 years old.
You can be a dual citizen.
He was a dual citizen for a long time.
So I wonder why, yeah.
Don't know why he
was. Because I know, like, Rupert Murdoch did because he had to, because if he was if he couldn't own so much media in America if he was a dual citizen.
Yeah, okay. I've written down his kids' names just because they have great names. So he's
Xylophone.
Amy Rainbow.
That's pretty.
Is that like one word?
No. Amy Rainbow.
Amy Rainbow.
And then his son is Harry Thunder.
Oh, that's cool.
And there's
cool.
One that's just Holly. It's not as funny. But Holly, Harry Thunder.
Holly Precipitation.
That's very good. It's so patronizing when I say that, isn't it? But I don't mean
I mean, only when you pat me on the head as you say it.
Well, you're just so cute.
Stop it.
Eric Idle wrote and put on Spamalot, which was based on, as we were saying before, based on Holy Grail. It opened in Chicago and has since played in New York, on Broadway, London, and numerous other major cities across the world.
Melbourne, Australia.
It definitely did.
Oh, did it? Cool.
It was nominated for 14 Tony Awards.
That's a lot.
14 is a lot of awards.
It's a lot of Tonys.
It won 3, so Best Musical, Best Direction, and Best Performance by a Featured Actress.
I imagine the Best Musical is the main one.
And then finally it brings us to Graham Chapman, who he completed his studies and was a registered doctor. I do remember hearing at some point that he was the doctor on set for Life of Brian, which I quite like. One way to cut, you know.
Cut a cost there.
So by the time Monty Python went on tour in 1973, his drinking had begun to affect his performance and he was missing cues on stage. He was forgetting lines. But by the time he stopped drinking in Christmas of 1977, concerned that he wouldn't be able to act properly in Life of Brian and remained sober for the rest of his life.
Oh, great. So yeah. He, because he was the lead role in Life of Brian and Holy Grail.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing that they thought he was the best actor. That's why they
put him in those roles.
But
they said he was the best actor of all.
I imagined that he just kept drinking and that's why.
So did I. I thought that was just a problem throughout his whole life. But he apparently stopped and didn't drink again.
How did he die?
He had throat cancer. So he was diagnosed with the throat cancer in 1989, and apparently John Cleese, Michael Palin, Peter Cook, and Chapman's partner, David Sherlock, were all there when he died. When he passed away, they were all there. And his death actually occurred the day before the 20th anniversary of Flying Circus. So the day before the 20th anniversary, and Terry Jones said it was the worst case of party pooping in all history.
Very good.
He died just before. Now, the five surviving Python members decided to stay away from his private funeral because it was just going to become a media circus.
Yeah.
So they sort of stayed away and gave his family some privacy. But they did send a wreath in the shape of the famous Python foot with the message, "To Graham from the other Pythons with all our love. P.S. Stop us if we're getting too silly." Which I really like.
Oh, man, you're going to make me cry.
A private memorial service for him was held 2 months later. John Cleese delivered a memorable eulogy to Chapman with a shock humour that he believed Chapman would have wanted. Later became the first person at a televised British memorial service to say fuck.
What a record!
I love that.
Yep.
So what he said in his eulogy, he said, I've got a quote here. "I guess we're all thinking how sad it is that a man of such talent, of such capability for kindness, of such unusual intelligence, should now so suddenly be spirited away. Well, I feel that I should say, nonsense. Good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard. I hope he fries." And, like, the whole church was just pissing themselves laughing. It was so funny. And Michael Palin delivered a eulogy as well. They all did, actually. It seems like most of them actually got up and said something. But Palin said Chapman had decided to die rather than listen to Palin once again. And Idol also led the other surviving Pythons and Chapman's close friends and family in a rendition of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And he closed it by saying, "I'd just like to be the last person at this meeting to say fuck." I do have a few fun facts to finish off with,
yes,
if I may.
That would be so good.
You sound really enthused.
I am so enthused. Oh.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm that keen.
Wait, I'm even more enthused.
I don't think so. I'd like to top your enthusiasm with this enthusiasm.
Okay, well, nice try, but I don't think it is quite as enthusiastic as I'm feeling right now.
Well, what have I told you that just before I was at 50% enthusiasm and now I'm at 85% enthusiasm?
85%? That's not bad, but my pie is bigger than yours and I'm giving you 93% of my bigger pie.
Well, 100% of my smaller pie, in fact, is a larger circumference than your pie. Well, it
seems like you've got me there, but oh no, I found another level and bloody hell, I am pumped.
Fun fact number one.
The Holy Grail was filmed on location in rural areas of Scotland with a budget of only £229,000. The money was raised in part with investments from rock groups such as Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin.
Oh, wow.
I think that's kind of cool. I didn't know that.
Neither did I.
That is a fun fact.
They had some cool friends.
They did have some cool friends.
And cool fans, I'll say, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure just appreciated their work.
Mm.
On St. George's Day, on the 23rd of April 2007, the cast and creators of Spamalot gathered in Trafalgar Square under the tutelage of the two Terrys and set a new record for the world's largest coconut orchestra.
How many members?
5,567 people, clip-clopping in time to the Python classic Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Wow.
For a Guinness World Record attempt. It says attempt, so I don't even know if they did it.
Do you think that we could beat that?
How many friends
is our listenership big enough for that yet?
No.
Get all in one place?
Definitely not. We'd have to fly them here. There are 7 asteroids named after Monty Python. So one for each of them and one just called Monty Python. So I think that's pretty cool. They've all got an asteroid named after them.
That's great.
How cool is that?
So there's a John Cleese.
There's a Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Michael Pate. They've got numbers in front of them.
John Cleese, have you keeping track of what he's got? He's got a lemur, he's got a pile of rubbish. And an asteroid.
He's doing all right. It's no airport like Edmund Hillary, but something.
Edmund Hillary also has a mountain on
Pluto.
On a Pluto.
Mountain range. It's not even just a mountain, it's a mountain range.
The John Cleese International Airport. I think it could happen in his lifetime.
It rings a couple of bells. Only a couple more. So in 2001, John Cleese was cast in the comedy Rat Race. Do you ever see Rat Race?
Yes, with Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah.
I didn't see it, but I've heard
Whoopi Goldberg.
And he played the eccentric hotel owner, Donald P. Sinclair. Do you recognise that name at all?
Donald P. Sinclair.
That was the name of the hotel owner who he based Basil Fawlty on.
Basil Fawlty.
How cool is that?
That's great.
I did not know. I couldn't even remember. Well done.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. Fun. All right, I've got two more. Michael Palin had a small cameo role in Home and Away.
What?
Michael Palin was on Home and Away.
What did he say or do?
He played an English surfer, which, I mean, totally. He looks like a gnarly dude. This is recently, by the way. He has a fear of sharks, and he interrupts a conversation between two main characters to ask whether there are any sharks in the sea. And yes, I found it on YouTube, and yes, I will tweet it.
Great.
Oh, and it's
horrendous.
Are there any sharks in the sea? No.
Carry on then. And the last one I have, it's probably not particularly funny for the last one to end on, but inside the Globe Theatre, there are commemorative stones to mark donors to the theatre. And Michael Palin has his own stone, but it's misspelt as Michael Palin, so two L's. And the story goes that John Cleese paid for the stone and insisted on misspelling his name as a joke. Gentlemen, that was my report on Monty Python that was hastily put together last night.
Well, I enjoyed your Monty Python report.
Thank you.
And I feel like going home and watching my favourite, Holy Grail, because, oh, man, every sketch in that movie makes me laugh so much. Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for the report, Jess. If you guys out there want to get in contact with us or suggest a topic, you can get in contact. Our hat that we're pulling topics out of is getting bigger and bigger by the minute. Or by the week. By the week, we'll say that. And you can tweet us at dogoonpod or dogoonpod@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We'll be back with a brand new report next week. And until then, enjoy yourself. What? I love you. Bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.